It's certainly a privilege to be here at Center. I was not the man assigned to this today, but there was a death in Anderson County, and so Donald Miller, who was scheduled to be here, took his wife and family there. His wife's grandmother passed on. That funeral is this morning as well. Just last week, we attended a funeral also. My brother-in-law, Edward Bontrager from Dixon, Tennessee, passed on. He is the brother-in-law who lost his wife back in March of 09. So we suddenly have a really big change in that part of our extended family. On Sunday morning, we were with the Lighthouse Mennonite Church. And we had a very good time there. Met a number of Merle Yoder's family and just appreciated being there. James Dobson tells the time that he was in the presence of a man who was afflicted with cancer. By the way, my sister-in-law and my brother-in-law both passed on because of cancer. And he tells the story of an African-American pastor who was afflicted with cancer. And he was given opportunity toward the end of his time here. And this is what to explain how he felt about this whole situation. Some of you have asked me if I'm mad at God for this disease that has taken over my body. I'll tell you honestly that I have nothing but love in my heart for my Lord. He didn't do this to me. We live in a sinful world where sickness and death are the curse that man has brought on himself. And I'm going to a better place where there will be no more tears, no suffering, no heartache. So don't feel bad for me. Then he began to sing without accompaniment in his old broken voice. I wept as this gentleman sang of his love for Jesus. He sounded very weak, and his face was drawn from the ravages of the disease. His words that morning were his last from the pulpit. He slipped into eternity a few days later, where he met the Lord that he had served for a lifetime. I think it's so important that we keep these things in proper perspective, and that we don't come to the place where we think we can demand God to answer our prayers the way we want them answered. Actually, planned what I'm sharing this morning back in the Christmas season, and some time has elapsed. I trust that it can still be a blessing to us here. I'd just like to say too to the workers in CASP, you're certainly welcome to come to Cedar Crest anytime you find time to do that. I won't be able to solve very many problems today. I want to talk to young parents especially, and I hope that this can be a blessing to us all. Even to those who are not yet young parents, to those who have been young parents, maybe are now grandparents, like myself. But I hope that I can say some things that point in God-honoring directions about these issues. One thing that comes to my mind is something that I read in Reader's Digest, I suppose, 50 years ago, by an Italian writer who was studying the social ills of the West, of North America, and the homes here. He's had a thesis, and his thesis was basically, if America's homes are going to get strong again, they have to put Father back at the head of the home. And I'm not sure what all that means. We have felt that we probably are not typical in the population at large, and yet there are a lot of things that tend to seep through to our homes and our values, especially if we're not aware of them. Is this only a man's problem? Well, no, I don't think it is. But we'll start there today. I had a man send me a book, and that was really the beginning of this message several weeks ago. I never met the man. His name is Patrick Morley. He wrote a book, Pastoring Men, and he sent me a copy. I appreciated it so much that I found myself looking into it. What gives this man some special credibility is that he grew up in a home that was not the most functional. And he explains. I'll come to that a bit later, but he talks about the men problem. And he says divorce courts are at capacity because of the men problem. Families are torn apart by it. Wives soak their pillows with tears as a result of it. Children grow up in poverty as a result of it. Men have become one of our largest neglected people groups. As a result, they are prone to get caught up in the rat race, lead unexamined lives, and become cultural rather than biblical Christians. Of the men married between 1970 and 74 in America today, just 42% are still married after 30 years. Of the 72 million children in America under the age of 18, 33% will go to bed tonight in a home without a biological father. Children in female-headed families are 5 times more likely to live in poverty, to repeat a grade, or have emotional problems compared to the families where a father is present. We've become a nation of spiritual widows and practical orphans. These are real people with real casualties. One police officer observed, "These statistics are just real tragedies with the tears wiped away." Morley says further, "Today's average man is like a deer caught in the headlights of a Hummer. He doesn't fully understand and so cannot apply what God has to say about a man's identity, purpose, relationships, marriage, fathering, work, money, ministry, time, emotions, integrity, and dozens of other subjects. As a result, many men are tired. They often have a lingering feeling that something isn't quite right about their lives. Often their lives are becoming unglued, and it is common for them to feel that nobody really cares. Even in the church, men are being left behind. Can we help each other? I hope so. Can a man like myself, who has much failure as a family man, bring something helpful? I'll admit to you freely, I'm outside my comfort zone, but I don't think it's right to sidestep this issue just because I'm uncomfortable, and I know that you know things that have not worked out well for us. I understand that God is asking me to help build young families to make them stronger. I'm going to start with something here that I heard some time ago, and I don't exactly remember the words that were used, but I hope that I can use words that are helpful. Someone talked about the diagram of successful training, child training methods, and said that if we are low in acceptance and love to the child, and we are also low in direction for the child and correction, we can expect a wild child. If we are high in acceptance and love, but low in correction and direction, we can expect an irresponsible child. If we are low in acceptance and love, and high in direction and correction, we can expect a listless, discouraged child. But if we are somehow able to have a higher level of acceptance and love, and a high level of direction and correction, we can expect some security, some contentedness, some feeling of being treasured by the people responsible for us. But every child, regardless what home he grows up in, and all of our homes are imperfect, I know. The home I grew up in is imperfect. The home that my children grew up in is imperfect. But everyone must still choose Christ as Savior and Lord. He must still renounce the world, the flesh, and the devil. Yesterday in Annie's mailbox, if you noticed, maybe you don't read that, but yesterday I thought there was something specially instructive there for teachers, especially those children who find themselves in schoolrooms where the teacher bullies the children and makes them so feel so unable to do things. I was a teacher, but I was also blessed to have a teacher that placed confidence in us that we can do things if we set our hearts to it, our minds to it. And I believe that we owe it to every child to help them find tasks that they can succeed at. Now, that every child, though, must still give himself fully to God. The first 3 categories can do it, but they'll probably have a harder time doing that. However, there is just nothing available to you and me that makes doing right all the time automatic. In the Garden of Eden, because God gave our first parents the freedom to choose, we see that. One thing that I felt that would be very instructive here was to go to Luke 2. And I'd like to just look at some of these early chapters in Luke. I won't be stopping there, but I'd just like to point out that we have a number of songs of praise in these early chapters of the Gospel of Luke. We have Elizabeth's song of praise, starting in chapter 1, verse 42. We have Mary's song of praise, often called the Magnificat, in verse 46 of that same chapter. And we have Zacharias' song of praise in verse 68 and following. Then when we come over into chapter 2, we have the angel's song of praise in verse 13 and 14. And then we have a beautiful song of praise from Simeon, an old man. This is a song of a praise of worship to God. And I just appreciated so much the way we were led in worship this morning, because it matches very much some of the thoughts that I hope to find here. Simeon was an older man, and somehow he had an affirmation in his spirit that he was going to get to see the Messiah that God would send into the world. They had waited for hundreds of years, and there was a period there between the close of the Old Testament and the New, really. It's often called the 400 silent years. But already, apparently, I don't know if he knew about Elizabeth and Mary and Zacharias' experience, but he had come to the temple and he was there to worship. Verse 29, Luke 2:29, he said this, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word. For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel." And Joseph and his mother marvel at those things which were spoken of him. And Simeon blessed them, and said unto Mary his mother, "Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed." It's just such a beautiful and insightful song of praise, a worship hymn. He worshiped God, and he thanked him for sending Messiah, and that he got to see him. It's a salvation hymn. He talks about how it is that now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace. That word depart is used in several ways. I understand the original word had at least four definitions, four ways that it was used. It was used when you release a prisoner from confinement. And so he felt, I think, that he was like a prisoner that was going to be released from the earthly confinement to go to his heavenly home. It's also used to untie a ship and to set sail. And certainly that would have been also seemed to apply to what he was facing. It was thirdly used to take down a tent. And certainly his tent was going to be taken down shortly. And fourthly, it was used to unyoke a beast of burden. I think he had borne the burdens of the day, and he was so glad to be able to go to where those burdens would not be on him anymore, where he would be living in a time of eternal bliss. It is also a missionary hymn, if you notice. Verse 31, "Which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel." He had the vision that this was not going to be just for God's chosen people. It was going to be for everyone around the globe. A light to lighten the Gentiles. Everyone. That's the implication there. Anna joined him in that song. She was a prophetess, and we just see something very beautiful there. But then we also go to another thing that happens here. And I think I'd just like to invite you to join me as we read this portion. This is the portion where Jesus, it's the only incident that is given in any of the four Gospels where what happened to Jesus between his eighth day and his beginning of his ministry at 30 years. So it starts at verse 41 and it goes through the end of the chapter. And I would like to ask you as a congregation to join me as we read this responsively. I will read verse 41 and you read 42 and so on. "Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover.
And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast.
And when they had fulfilled the days, as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem. And Joseph and his mother knew not of it.
But they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance.
And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him.
And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions.
And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers.
And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said to him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing.
And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business?
And they understood not the saying which he spake unto them.
And he went down with them, and came to Nazareth, and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart.
And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, and in favor with God and man.
Thank you. Thank you. I see a number of things, parenting pointers, in this passage, starting at verse 21, that I'd just like to point out now. In fact, I'm going to point out 10 and dwell on them briefly. Back in verse 22, we have the verse that says that Joseph and Mary presented this 8-day-old child to the Lord. You know, that's one wonderful parenting principle, to recognize that our children are gifts of God. They're given to us. And we cannot actually fully decide how they're going to live and how God is going to use them. They are gifts to us. And so we give them back to God. In verse 25, we notice that they sought the blessing and company of those who were just and devout. It's good for a family to seek out the company of other God-fearing souls. That's part of good parenting. To find and get along with other Christian people. There are three times in these verses where they went to the temple, verse 22 and 27 and 37. And also back then in 41 where they went to the feast. So it's so important. I think that this marks a successful Christian family where they take the family to religious services. It just does not work well when somehow, maybe for some reason, we fall out and we think that we can go ahead without the benefit of the church. It's important to attend church. When Simeon took this child, we find another point here on good parenting. He took the child in his arms. There's something wonderful about the gift of touch that blesses a child. I'm told that there was once an orphanage in Africa. I don't remember exactly how this was. I studied this years and years ago in a community health course. How they had children that were there without benefit of their parents. And these caretakers were so busy that about all they could do was pop a bottle in its mouth and prop up the bottle and so on. And they noticed that these children were not prospering. And when they changed the program to pick up the child and hold it and cuddle it, and so that it had a human touch, they started to flourish. And it was different for them. And so we believe that this is one of those parenting pointers that are given here by Simeon when he took the child in his arms and blessed him. Notice also that Joseph and Mary marveled, both in verse 33 and 47. You know, there's a difference between a teachable spirit and the attitude that says, we have arrived. We've got it together. It's always a dangerous thing, as we observed in the life of this king in Israel. They had not arrived. They were on a journey of faith, and they were literally, his parents were on a journey. They did a lot of traveling in those early days, in a time when it wasn't very easy to be traveling. But they journeyed, and that was their experience spiritually as well. They were on a journey of faith, seeking God's will and his approval. They were not overly confident, but they were trusting God. And that's the best I think any of us can do. Notice verse 34, that when Simeon spoke to them and said, this child is set for the fall and rising again of many in Israel, for a sign which shall be spoken against. Every life has trials. And those children that God gives to us will also have trials. We can't predict how all this will go. But we can help them to try to look to God when those times come up. Every life has trials. Then as we cross over into that incident that is given at the end of this chapter, we notice another good example. They took the 12-year-old to the temple. Now, that was the time, I think, when Jewish parents who were serious about the task of bringing up their family for God would take the child and to at least one annual feast. There were three annual feasts for them, and devout parents would often take in all three if they could, but sometimes there was a question of economics. They could not afford all three. I understand that a Jewish parent was to give his young son three things. If I have this right, he was to teach him the law, he was to teach him a trade, and Joseph certainly taught his son a trade. He was referred to as the carpenter, the son of a carpenter, and also to find him a wife. Now, just when that would take place, we don't know, but I think that already these parents realized that probably if he was to be the Messiah, he would not be a man with a family. We don't know that. But these people had the teachableness to marvel at what the Lord was saying through these different people. And that is a wonderful attitude to retain as parents. Notice also in verse 45 that they were concerned when the boy Jesus, 12-year-old boy, was missing. I'd say that wise parents still want to know where their 12-year-olds are. And I don't think it stops at 12. I don't think it starts there. I think it's right for parents to have a concern about where their children are. Notice verse 48. It seems that Mary rebuked him. She really did not appreciate that he got himself lost. But I notice that another good thing here that goes for parents. I think good parents still call their children to account. His answer was kind of surprising. I don't think it was cheeky because he never sinned. But I think he was simply concentrating on the things that he sensed that he should do. And I don't think that at this point in 12 years of age, he had all his earlier powers back yet. I give this for whatever it's worth. But it seems to me that maybe God did not give him that all-knowingness that he had with the Father when he was in heaven until he began his ministry. And when he began his ministry, you remember that he was baptized. A dove came and settled on his shoulder, was it, or his head, and a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." Then I think he had it all. You see, in John, the end of chapter 2, it says that Jesus didn't require anyone to tell him what was in people's minds. He knew. He had that omniscience, knowing those all things. Nevertheless, these parents of this 12-year-old asked for and got his continued obedience. Verse 51. He came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. I think it's important for parents to not let up too much, but to be careful and thorough and loving as they continue to give guidance through those growing up times. And then we notice the normal growth that he experienced in wisdom, stature, and in favor with God and favor with man. We have often called this the four point growth of the life: intellectual, physical, spiritual, and social. I mentioned that this man who sent me this book had less than an ideal beginning. I'm going to just let him speak for himself. I have this concern for personal reasons. In 1926, when my dad was 2, the youngest of 4 children, his father, deserted the family. The stress got the best of my grandmother. She had a stroke, so she and her 4 young children moved in with 2 of her unmarried sisters, my great aunts. Together, these 3 women raised my dad and his siblings. They did a great job, but they were dirt poor. In those days, long before government programs, the community closed ranks when some of their people were in need. The one sister who worked was an elevator operator. Knowing the situation, the employer paid her a generous salary that would be roughly equal to $15 an hour in today's dollars. She bought groceries each day on her way home. The grocer told her, "Nina, you take whatever you need and pay whatever you can." When my dad turned 6, he went to work with an older brother, Harry. They had 2 jobs. They rose every morning at 3 a.m. to deliver milk and then worked a paper route. The school gave them a permanent tardy slip. My dad never knew the warmth of a father's embrace. He never felt the scratch of his dad's whiskers. He never overheard his dad whistling or singing while he worked. He never smelled his work clothes. Never heard him joke around or read a bedtime story. Never tossed a ball. Never felt a dad tousle his hair. Never heard him say, "I love you, son. I'm proud of you, son." And never felt a father's approval or guidance. When Dad became a man, he had to decide if he would repeat or break the cycle. As the oldest of four boys, I'm grateful my dad wanted to break that cycle, but fathering was unexampled to him. So our family joined a church because Dad and Mom wanted to get some moral and religious instruction for their four sons. Our church had a vision to put my dad to work, and because of his strong work ethic, he responded to the challenge. By age 40, he was top layman in the church. I suppose that's what he thought it must mean to be a good Christian. There was a lot of work to do in the church, but our church did not have a vision to disciple my dad, to be a godly man, a father and husband, the real reason he had joined. He did the best he could, but he was left to guess at how to father my brothers and me. Something happened in the church that hurt my mother's feelings. And my dad was burnt out. So we quit church when I was in the 10th grade and my youngest brother was in the 3rd grade. Our family was soon hit by a force from which we have still not fully recovered. I quit high school in the middle of my senior year. My brother Robert followed in my footsteps. He eventually died of a heroin overdose. My other two brothers have had a variety of employment, substance, and marriage issues. My dad just never saw it coming. If he could have seen around the bend, I'm sure he would have done things differently. If he were still alive, I know he would say, "I take full responsibility. That was my decision, and I respect that." Every man does need to take responsibility for his own life. But I would like to suggest that the church could have done more. The church knew or should have known that what was around the bend. The church should have had a vision to disciple my dad, but they didn't. Fortunately, God is the Redeemer, and this story took another turn. I fell in love with Patsy. She went forward at the Billy Graham Crusade to publicly profess faith at the age of 11 and has never wavered. God graciously grafted the gospel back into my family line through Patsy's family line, and Patsy led me to Christ. Then God allowed me the joy of leading my brother Robert, the one that died of heroin overdose later, to Christ before he died. Another brother has also professed Christ, and so has my only niece on this side of the family. Dad and Mom also both came to Christ, or came back, I'm not sure. Neither one of them ever got over their bitterness toward the church, but they both affirmed their faith in Jesus on their deathbeds, so we can hope, I guess. Both of my children can never remember a time when they didn't love Christ. They are now both married to fantastic Christian spouses and serving the Lord. I wish my father were alive today so I could tell him, "Dad, we did break the cycle. It should have taken only one generation, and it took two, but we did break the cycle." Well, when we come to trying to address some of these things, we know there are various things that perhaps can give us some help. I've noticed something that I really liked in Midwest Focus and had reprinted in Calvary Messenger last summer. I'm just going to refer to it now. When Howard Bean talked about the self-esteem trap, how do we get a proper self-evaluation, a proper view of oneself across to a child? And he speaks about the fact that maybe that was overdone in some generations recently past. And I'll read a little bit of Howard Bean's comments. In the book Self-Esteem Trap, Eisendrath observed that the generation mirrors who were born between 1970 and 2000 tend to be discontented because a sense of entitlement has been cultivated in them by parents and teachers. This psychologist labels their problem the self-esteem trap. She views it as a cultural problem that began about 1980 when there was a strong emphasis on self-esteem, in which parents offered much approval and enthusiasm to make their children feel extraordinary instead of helping children realize and accept their strengths and weaknesses. In other words, that they are highly valued, but ordinary. When children develop a sense of entitlement, they tend to become restless, dissatisfied, feel pressure to be exceptional, have trouble accepting responsibilities, and struggle with feelings of superiority or inferiority, instead of feeling happy, positive, and capable, such children feel disappointed and frustrated. Wise parents teach a child not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly. Communicate to children that each one is loved and valued by God and appreciated, plus treasured and respected by you. Thank God for them in their hearing. Praise them judiciously and generously. Don't flatter or exaggerate their abilities or importance. Help them see their faults, weaknesses, and sins. Correct them. Be an example of humility, courtesy, self-respect, and godliness. Direct the child to the majesty and magnificence of God. A mountain compares favorably with a molehill until both are humbled by the stars. Don't develop in children a sense of being entitled, but rather of being unworthy, as Jacob said, "I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant." How shall we affirm a child without making them harmfully proud or self-assured? One thing I think can help us is to compliment achievement rather than ability. There is, I think, a substantial difference between telling a child, "You're wonderful," or telling them, "You did well." A man's identity comes in some measure from his father's blessing. One person said, I don't know who it was, but I just read this also in a book, that said, "No matter what I did, I could not please my father." It reminded me of a man that I did know in his middle years, who had an especially good year and had raised some hogs, and they brought in a nice return. And he decided to share it with his dad, thinking that his dad would enjoy his success and would just say something positive about it. But his father somehow could not think of that and said to him, "Yes, but you know what? It won't always work out that well." Well, of course, the son knew that, but it was still discouraging to him that his father could not affirm him. Remember when Jacob took Esau's blessing, and oh, how bitterly Esau was disappointed when he got into his father's presence and had carefully prepared a meal for him, after which he would give him his birthright and his blessing. And when he discovered that Jacob had tricked him out of it, he said with tears, I think it says in Hebrews, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." And I note that children, regardless where they are, the father's blessing is just very important. And it doesn't work to just tell them, "Just get over it." I think we fathers must learn to bless our children. We must also realize that when we have to correct, that we should need calm confidence. This is not the place for railing. This is not the place for ranting or to lose our cool. This is the time to encourage and correct where necessary, and to follow on through. It's not just that we are fathering for performance. We are fathering the heart. If we always father for performance, and then the child faces failure, he can feel so devastated. God had given us a perfect example when his son was here. And he was baptized, that voice from heaven came that said, "This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased." And at the transfiguration, he said the same things and added these words yet, "Hear ye him." I think that this speaks so much to us, how the father related to the son. A father can have too much structure, micromanage the children's lives, but he can also have not enough structure so that the child is frustrated. This Morley, as he wrote about his father's struggles and some of the things that he had gone through because his father had such a hard time growing up, one day he said, when I was in my 30s, we were walking back to our vehicles. I said, "Here, Dad, let me give you a hug." This was not common in their family. And he said his father gave him a hug. It was really a bear hug. I think he called it a grizzly bear hug. Then he let out a long sigh. And all I could think of was his deeply buried pain at not having a father to affirm him, who abandoned their mother and the children. And I said to him, "I love you, Dad." And Dad said, "I love you." And he said, "We left each other. I just felt it was a transforming moment. Our souls had been cleansed." And I think God gives us things like this to help bring back the blessing that he has. A man who worked in prisons, he was working and had a class of some 40 young men in their middle teens who had done serious crimes. I won't name them all, but he found that over 90% of these young men did not have a noble father figure. And so he worked with them to try to get them to understand what God really wanted for them. And he had them repeat after him. I'll use the name John Doe, but of course that was that's just a filler. "God knows your name. John Doe, he loves you very much. He knit you together in your mother's womb. He knows every word you speak before it comes to your tongue. He knows when you sit and when you stand." And then he gave them some scripture from Psalm 139. "O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb." He knows everything you've ever done and all you will do, and he wants to forgive you for any sin you've done. If you will reach out to him, he's already reaching out for you. You can change your life. God wants to adopt you and be your father. Do you understand this? And then he explained further. "Why do I do this? I want them to know their identity, who they were created to be. Then that Jesus Christ is available to them, even though they've done bad things." So much of our identity comes from our Father's blessing. We have an example of that in the Old Testament in 2 Samuel 11. I will read a few verses, but mostly I'll just talk about this. It's in this chapter that David steals Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, and then arranges for her husband's death. When Nathan the prophet came and confronted David, he acknowledged his guilt. And Nathan explained that because of this, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me and taken Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah." And then he went on ahead to explain some further sordid sins and terrible situations that would follow. And before long, Amnon violated Tamar, a daughter of David. This was one of the sons of David. He had a number of wives, and so they weren't full siblings, I don't believe. Absalom was incensed at Amnon and eventually murdered him. Well, Absalom fled to Geshur. I think it had to do with his own safety, and it may have been that there would be others that would take revenge on him. I'm not sure of all that. But he went there and was stayed there for 3 years. And finally, someone thought of a way to get him back to Jerusalem. But David, his father, refused to communicate with him. It's a very strange thing how David acted. In 2 Samuel 14, 24, "And the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face." And in verse 28 of that same chapter, "So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face." He's back in Jerusalem and Dad pays no attention to him. And so finally, someone just really pressed this on David. And so finally in verse 33 of that same chapter, "And when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom." But there had some things gone wrong in Absalom's self-perception here. He was a handsome man. It says in verse 25 of that same chapter, "But in all Israel there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head there was no blemish in him." He demanded to see his father, and it wasn't happening there. And so we have, before that final incident that we referred to a minute ago, where he actually set Joab's fields on fire because he wanted to have an audience with Joab, and of course, ultimately with David. Absalom had a major father wound. He, in chapter 15, it tells us that he stole the hearts of Israel, and he formed a conspiracy, and so David had to get out of Jerusalem because he was setting himself up to be the king. And finally, then, Joab did kill him when his head was caught in a tree, and he was hanging there from that. His mule ran out from under him, and he was left hanging there. Why did David shut Absalom out like this? Was he in denial? Did he hope that Nathan's dire predictions could be reversed? You know what? Problems don't go away when we ignore them. David was perhaps trying to hold shut a door on a very bad situation that had developed in the wake of his adultery and murder. He should have just faced it and repented. And maybe it was after that that he wrote Psalm 51. I don't know. Well, I want to say a few things to mothers too. And I feel very unsure about what I should say here. But I'm going to let Morley do some help me here. Not many of us want to talk badly about our mothers. I know I feel guilt even writing that sentence. However, when my mother passed away, I confess that I did not feel anything. That was odd. So I went into Christian counseling. My counselor concluded that I was not the product of good parenting. Essentially, I was not mothered. There was a lack of touch, verbal affection, and time, which indicates a betrayal, if not intended. I was a little boy with a hole in my soul. Something was missing. I didn't feel precious and deeply cared for. A little boy cannot handle the thought, my mother does not delight in me. I'm not loved. Apparently, I decided, if they don't need me, then I don't need them either. My counselor thinks I pushed my parents away because I couldn't handle the thought that they really didn't want me, real or imagined. I know I wanted to be wanted. Why is love taught more from the scripture to men than to women? Does this mean that all women are naturally as loving as they ought to be? Apparently, this is something that a woman needs to cultivate as well. I thought of, well, what else can we find for the sisters? I thought of Proverbs 31. And I thought of the virtuous woman that King Lemuel wrote about there. And I noticed that she was praised for her diligence and her management and all good that stuff. Is there nothing about her relationships? But I found it. This is what it says in verse 26. She opens her mouth with wisdom, kindness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. So she's not just a woman of action. She's also a woman of gracious words and attitudes. She's a woman who cultivates a good relationship with her children. And that is not possible if the woman is only passive. She needs a spine that can stiffen, even though she has a soft touch. So, I see the time is here to quit. Let me just say this in summary, and then we'll come before the Lord in prayer. In summary, we often tell the children to be obedient. I don't want to take anything away from that. But today, we have tried to help Mom and Dad, and I just pray that somehow God can use this so that we can be truly biblical Christians, and not just cultural Christians. Let's kneel and pray. Gracious God, our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege we've had of looking into your word this morning. We believe that you want to bless it to our hearts. We just thank you that you've blessed us with children. Oh, Father, these children are a gift from you, and we just thank you for it, for them. I pray that you would also bless the young parents that are here, and especially encourage their hearts in the tasks that are before them. I pray for the parents in the middle years, that you would also bless them as they relate to their teenage children and older. And for the grandparents, Father, just help us to realize what we can do and to pray for these families in our midst and to be an encouragement where we can. I ask that you would just be with us further as we wait before you. May your words bless our hearts and minds and souls as we draw near to you and as we realize how much of our life depends on you. We give you glory and praise in Jesus' name. Amen. Julian, you just finish as you see best. See, I took plenty of time already.